Welcome to the Sports Ethicist Show, coming to you from the basement of Burpee on the campus of Rockford University in Sportstown, USA, Rockford, Illinois. I am Sean Klein, the Sports Ethicist. The Sports Ethicist Show discusses the many ethical and philosophic issues that arise in and around sport. You can read the Sports Ethicist blog at sportsethicist.com, where you can also download podcasts of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, or find links to related information. The Sports Ethicist is on Facebook and Twitter, and you can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. Well, today we have a special episode where we bring in the speakers from the Sports Studies Symposium, which we just finished up. This is the third annual Sports Studies Symposium that we've had at Rockford University. Although this is the first one as Rockford University, right? We were still
Rockford College last year.
My co-host there, Michael Perry.
Yeah, and we're officially annual now because you need 3 years to be officially annual. I learned that somewhere.
Okay, yeah. So although we were calling it annual from day one because we were very optimistic about its success. And it was great. We had great turnout, a lot of good discussion. And so it's always fun to come on to do the podcast to bring some of the speakers in and continue some of that talk and bring it to the masses that couldn't attend today's event. So on the first panel today, we had two speakers because one set couldn't come. I did read their paper, but we're not really going to talk about that because I don't really know what to say about that. I could read it again, but I don't know I'm going to do that. But I mean, it's a very interesting paper about skateboarding and it's rewilding of the urban landscape, which I thought was pretty interesting. So, I mean, we could talk about it if you guys want to.
The paradox that they mentioned was interesting. It's a natural way to bring it up. I might want to talk about it.
I thought it was interesting. I think they would have done a better job than I did in terms of presenting it, but,
most of us would.
Hey. All right.
Nice.
We're getting started early. the panel also consisted of, Dr. Sean Beckman. Dr. Beckman has been on the show before, talking about fitness and athletics and so on. And he talked some of that about that today in his talk, Burning the Straw Man, the 10,000 hour rule, fitness and athletics. Gave us a nice biology lesson about muscles and so on. So very interesting stuff.
I try.
Our other speaker is Major Kevin Scheman. I'm screwing it up again.
Every Scheman, time.
No, that's you had it right the first time.
Scheman?
I mean, there's a lesson in that, right? Never cross out your first answer. You had it.
Yeah. There you go. It's in my mind, you know. The worst is when you do that with students, when you screw up a name in the beginning of the semester and then forever you constantly screw up their name. So I do that a lot. Major Scheman is an Army major. And he's at the U.S. Military Academy in Westport, New York, where he teaches in the English and the Philosophy Department there. And he talked about whether or not hopscotch is a sport. and so really a very interesting and thought-provoking discussion. So first, let me ask Sean to say just a couple sentences about what you talked about today.
Sure. So my main focus was really – back on the ever-running question of the nature versus nurture debate and how much of what we do can we actually control, particularly when it comes to athletics. You know, this concept of the 10,000-hour rule that has kind of been co-opted to imply that with 10,000 hours of directed or dedicated practice that you can become an expert at things or an elite athlete, so to speak.
So I got a few more podcasts to do before I get good at this then.
Just a couple. Yeah. But going beyond that, the question is, from an athletic perspective, how much of that is true and how much of it is actually governed by our underlying genetics? And so my main focus of my talk was focusing on the underlying genetics of athletics versus fitness. For example, average human being has about 50% slow twitch muscle fibers and 50% fast twitch muscle fibers. A sprinter, on the other hand, may have up to 85% fast twitch fibers. A marathoner may have up to 85% slow twitch fibers. You can't switch fiber types, so you can't be a marathoner and become a sprinter or vice versa. So there is some nurture to it. We can control to some extent what we become physically, but we're still bound by our underlying genetics.
Right. Yeah, and you talked a little bit about Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers book where he talks about that. And we also talked about David Epstein and his book, The Sports Gene, And one of the interesting stories that he tells or anecdotes that he talks about in there is in modern Olympics, current Olympics, he says you can give someone, you know, someone who knows this stuff, a listing of the athletes and their specifications, their height, their weight, and so on. And you can – that those kind of experts can get with really high probability get the guess right of what they compete in just by their body type, how tall they are and all those factors, and guess whether they're a shot putter or they're a track runner or they're a swimmer or whatever. And that I think speaks a large part to – because those kinds of things are under genetic determination, right?
Absolutely, yeah. How tall you're going to be, what your ratio of your torso to your leg length is going to be, how long your arms and legs are going to be, their size are all, to a very large extent, genetically predetermined. They're mm-hmm. determined in your genes with some additional factors going into it.
There's a large heritability factor.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to, you know, the Summer Olympics a few years back where on NBC they put up this big sport science graphic of why is Michael Phelps built to be a swimmer? Mm-hmm. And it was, he's got paddles, basically. He's got paddles and oars for his appendages. And his percentage of torso to leg length makes him ideal for propelling through the water.
Right. Yeah. Now, one question I had about this 10,000 hour rule. So, you know, Mike and I, we could do 10,000 hours in the batting cage and we're not gonna make a major league team, right? You know, and so that just shows, okay, 10,000 hours, it's not an automatic thing. And I think even Gladwell and other proponents of that are gonna admit that. But anyway, when we talk about the elite athletes, is there some sense that maybe they, even though not anyone can just do the 10,000 or 20,000 hours to get at that level, but that even the elite athlete, given their genetic predispositions, they still need to put in something like an average of 10,000 hours to get at the level that they're at, or is there even more variability?
I would say there's even more variability in the amount of time they have to put in. The point is, though, they have to put in the time.
Yeah.
There is, again, nature versus nurture. It isn't nature versus nurture. It's nature and nurture. You need both. Their genetics predisposes them to being good at this, but I don't care how predisposed you are to being a marathon runner. If you don't put in the effort to train to become a marathon runner, if you're not going to do that, you may be a marathon runner, but you're not going to be an elite mm-hmm. marathon runner. Right. You're not going to be a world record marathon runner. You're not going to win the Boston Marathon. Likewise, you may have all the fast twitch muscle fibers in the world that are going to make you good at swinging a bat, so to speak. You may have the reaction time. You may have extra myelin in your neurons that makes you more prone to having, you know, nerve fibers firing more rapidly, so to speak. But unless you train that, unless you work with that, unless you focus on that, and unless you do it in a directed manner of how do I get better at it, it's not going to make a difference. You're not going to get there without putting the effort in. You need both.
In a way, it might be that something like the 10,000 hour rule is still there and operative for the elite athletes, but it's not just a generic claim. And then also, right, one of the things that I think gets lost in the translation when Gladwell talks about it is that the 10,000 hour rule is meant to be, it was an average,
right?
Some people it took 50,000 hours, some people it took 1,000 before they could reach certain, depending on the skill set. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And if you look at the original studies that Gladwell really worked off of, these psychological studies done by Anders Ericsson, there was massive variation. You had some individuals that were, you know, 1,000 hours and they could just master it. They just had an inherent skill. There were mm-hmm. others, it's 50,000 hours or more. And it's all over the place. So 10,000 is an average. And there's a massive deviation around that average.
I can't help but think of it in terms of what I do as far as one of the things teaching writing and this idea of, you know, you want to be a writer, write for 10,000 hours or read for 10,000. You know, I mean, yeah, if you don't do that, you're not going to be a writer. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, just because you do it for 10,000 hours doesn't mean you're going to be a good writer.
Even if you do it in a deliberate way.
I think that's a similar kind of concept, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it is one of those things that kind of apply. I mean, you know, this wasn't originally developed as an area of study around sports. It started around a study around music. It then moved into gamesmanship and mastery of games and then gradually progressed into a study of sports. And so absolutely, skill it's not inherited to skills associated with athletes. Mm-hmm. It's skills in general across life.
Mm-hmm. So. Cool. So, Kevin, tell us about hopscotch.
Sure. I mean, and I guess actually hopscotch plays, it's become the sort of central example, but because it's fun and who doesn't love hopscotch, but my view that what I'm trying to argue is really that, there's a sort of really popular, I take it to be sort of a conceptual analysis, though some people disagree that that's what Suits is doing, account of what it means for an activity to be a sport. And I agree with probably a lot of it. I mean, I actually find myself wondering how much I actually disagree with Suits. But he says there's at least five things going on here, that if a thing is a sport, then it's got to be a game. It's got to be a game of skill, so not a game of chance. The skill has to be physical, and I actually agree with all of that. But where I come to have some disagreement is he says that it also has to have a wide following, and it has to have stability. So it has to be popular, and it has to have institutions like coaching and training. And I suppose my point is, and what I'm trying to use hopscotch to illustrate, is that it seems like he's kind of got this backwards, right? That maybe what's going on when we call something a sport is that we're just suggesting that this is an appropriate thing to invest considerable time and effort in, right? So it's strictly a social fact. Like, we're conferring on it a sort of approval. And as a result of that, it's going to develop popularity and a sort of stability if it's the right sort of game, if it's going to track the sort of things that we generally attribute that property to, right? And we attribute that property to games that aren't sports. Chess, for example. People think that's the sort of game that one can invest considerable time in. And my suggestion is just a step further that, look, at the end of the day, I think understanding this is a fundamental feature of sport probably goes a long way towards understanding the sort of cultural significance we attribute to sports. And I think hopscotch is a case where it might well satisfy Suits' definition, but I think most of us recognize it's not a sport. It's a game. It's a popular game. But it doesn't have a wide following. And frankly, I mean, I have concerns that saying that something has to have a wide following is a bit circular, right? So, to say that something's a sport if and only if it has a wide following sufficient to be a sport strikes me as not getting me very far from the start. So I guess one of my concerns, like, is I think there's probably good games that are physical games that we don't think of as sports. I don't think it's like a one-to-one correlation. I think it's maybe kind of spongy, to use a technical term. So that's all I'm arguing. And like I said, I guess it's not a good start when I'm not even sure how much I disagree with the guy that I'm criticizing. But, that's the view. So I think there is a sort of normative element to this. I'm saying some games are good games or better games than others. And, I suspect some people might suggest that's not the case. So.
Mm-hmm. I
thought when you said it, during your speech was, if somebody looks at me like I'm not crazy, then there's something to that calling it a sport. But if I said I'm going to hopscotch finals and somebody looks at you like it's crazy, but what made me think about that is how then that using that definition and makes what is a sport something that is fluid, something that's fluctuating. Again, applying it to what I do, if I'm going to study a certain genre, a certain author, a certain, you know, there are certain times when I can say, hey, I'm going to do a paper on Stephen King. And they can say, great, I can do other places and times I could do that. And somebody look at me, well, that's not, why would you do that? You know,
that's not literature.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, King's gotten past that now, but, you know, but there are that genre, it's like a genre debate. And I think that genre debate's similar to what is a sport debate as far as when you connect it to value and what is a legitimate, use of one's time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I like the idea that it connects to value, right? And mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's obvious reason to think that we value different things across different cultures. So, I mean, that's one of the things that's problematic about this, right? How do we make sense out of cricket? Arguably the second most popular sport in the world behind soccer, which, I mean, interestingly, the two most arguably popular sports in the world are not particularly popular. I mean, soccer is gaining a foothold, and it's also the fifth most popular sport in the United States, right? By a lot of metrics. So how do you regard cricket, right? This sport is really popular outside the United States, But around here, like, people, why are you playing cricket? Right? Yeah. Like, there's lots of, how do you even find a cricket league, right? Like, there's just not the institutions to support it.
I have no idea even what a cricket game looks like.
I tried to figure it out.
They basically flatten the bat. I think that's it. And they make center field behind you. I'm not, a cricket expert, if that's not
it. It goes for 5 days, right?
It can go on.
8 hours. Yeah, it's crazy.
So, more to the point, right? Like, none of us even know how it's played.
I mean, one issue that comes up in particularly when you talk about suits and you talk about his definition of sport and the claim that all sports are games, is the debate in the literature about that claim, right? And so you have, Klaus Meyer who criticizes that and offers some counterexamples to the claim that all sports are games. So I didn't bring it up earlier because it didn't seem like it was really part of the conversation, but it is something that would have to be dealt with in your paper. Is that claim that there are sports that really don't conform to an understanding of it being a game. And so Meyer's, some of his examples are things like, diving, right? That a lot of the judged sports, they don't really seem to be games in conventional senses, but even really even in terms of his definition, what is the inefficient or unnecessary obstacle that's placed in front of the diver, right? In terms of, and then in terms of the movements that they, to do the, what is it called? Like a pike or whatever, right? Or straight dive, like and then the prelusory goals, right? That they're not always clear in the way that chess is, right? So those are some borderline cases that make it hard to see, or like one of the examples we used in terms of cheerleading, competitive cheerleading. How is that really a game? Is that the same thing as Monopoly, as football?
Yeah. So, I mean, actually there's two ways to respond to this. First, for the paper, I've kind of fixed the discussion of games. I mean, I think there's an open discussion to be had there. And one thing is that maybe there is a way to fit something like diving into Suit's definition of what constitutes a game. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe the more interesting discussion in terms of those sorts of sports, because they tend to be sports that are sort of aesthetically judged, right, is whether or not those sorts of sports can have a level of objectivity that's conducive with calling them a sport, right? I mean, this is one of the things I wonder about. Boxing, it seems to come up a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Disputed scorecards. I mean, so clearly it fits the mold of a game right up until the point where nobody wins and we have to decide via scorecards, right? So I think that's an open question, and it's certainly worth developing. I mean, my sense is that if we wanted to make an argument that diving isn't a game, it strikes me that it would be more likely that it's not a game by Suits's definition than it isn't a game by sort of broader, like if we just asked people, if we said, hey, when we're using this word game, does this describe what you're talking about? It seems, I think most people would be willing to concede that it is a game. So then we start looking.
I mean, in my anecdotal experimental philosophy, it's played out the other way.
Really?
Is, you know, people who aren't trained in philosophy or anything like that, and I ask them, you know, diving a game? No, it's a sport. Right? And they draw that distinction in a way that's conducive more to Meyer's argument than it is to Suits's claim.
I've heard some people argue too that Suits isn't actually trying to do conceptual analysis. He's not trying to figure out how we use the term sport, but understand offer some sort of technical definition. And I mean, if those people are right, then it's certainly not a project that I think is particularly interesting, right?
Yeah, no, I think he's doing. I think he's doing conceptual analysis. I do think that I think he's trying to get at he's trying to get at the essence and nature of what sport is and make that definition. So. If that's conceptual analysis, I think that's what he's doing.
Think of diving, the game quality to diving is, let's see who can make the smallest splash. Or if you're in the playgrounds with kids, let's see who can make the biggest splash. Mm-hmm. Or let's do a follow the leader off the boat. So, I mean, there's a game element to it. You're not just jumping into the water, but you have something you're trying to accomplish as you're jumping. You're trying to look cool. Or you're trying to, I mean, or you're trying to not make a splash if you're diving, or you're trying to, or
after
trying to
doing
cannonball.
Certain prescribed movements and so on.
Certain movements and jumps. So in that sense, I think it, but.
Well, I mean, and actually just to go back to the first point, I mean, it strikes me that there is a goal there, right? Like just because we can't see it as clearly as a prelusory goal in something like basketball, right? What's a prelusory goal? Basketball?
Ball through hoop.
Winner, right?
Yeah.
there's still a goal, right? And in some ways, you're kind of defining the goal within set parameters. Like, I'm going to do this dive, and here are the sort of technical merits that I need to achieve in order to do the dive well, right? So I guess I start to think of sort of Hume's account to talk about stuff that never comes up when you're talking about philosophy of sport, I suppose. But when he talks about sort of convergence of judgments of taste, right? Like that we may not get complete convergence, but it seems like we can get something approximating it, right? Like, so if you have people that have sufficient faculties and are sufficiently experienced, then more often than not, I mean, they might disagree, but frankly, they're going to disagree at the margins, right? People that drink beer are, and this may be a bad example, but they're going to say like a Dogfish Head 60 Minute is just objectively a better beer than a Coors Light, right? I guess my sense would be that. And this is sort of the response I have when people sort of recoil against the idea that we could judge anything in a sport, right? Because I'm not totally convinced that that's so different than what we do in football, right? Yeah. Like holding is, it really is a sort of subjective judgment in terms of how we interpret the rule. So we just know when somebody scores a touchdown. Yeah. That's obvious.
Yeah, I go back and forth on the Sutzmeier debate on the claim there, on that tricky triad of sports game. And then they throw play in there as a discussion element too. And so that makes things even more complicated.
Yeah. My sports rhetoric students this semester, we put hobby into that issue too. And boy, that even made it more so. The difference between hobby, sport, and game.
Yeah. Yeah, because a lot of the ways in which we probably engage in sport is probably more of a hobby than it is an athletic event or something, right? And this kind of comes back to Sean's point about eliteness and fitness and athleticism in that way.
Right. The how much are you practicing to get better and how much are you just going out and by virtue of playing with someone else, practicing just to do it with no necessary intention of getting better in the process.
Right. Cool. All right. Thanks, guys, for both coming to the symposium and coming onto the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right. Now we have our speakers from our second panel from the Sports Studies Symposium today. We have Zachary Draves, right?
Yep.
All right. I know I messed up your name on the flyer. Just wanted to make sure I got it right this time.
That's okay.
Zach is a student here at Rockford University. He's a political science major.
Correct.
Yeah. And he gave a talk today on sport and society, how athletics shape our world and consciousness. We also have Houston Ladner, who is a graduate student and getting his PhD in American Studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And you talked today about the convergence of mechanization and the modern athlete in NASCAR is the sort of specific focus. And we also have returning both to the symposium as well as the podcast, Carl Robinson, who's an associate professor of English at Ashford University over in Clinton, Iowa. And he got his PhD from Kent State University in 2004. And you talked, reading some excerpts from your dissertation, The Modern Literature of Ring Sport, A Cultural Phenomenon and Its Literary Forms. Right. It's funny when you can't say a word like literary. You should be able to say that, right? and that focused on professional boxing, wrestling, and the play element inherent in sport.
All right.
Good. We got some good discussion going, both in terms of the interesting talks you guys gave and then also the question and answer afterwards. And so for the people who weren't able to go, we want to bring this to the masses. So if each of you could maybe say just, one or two sentences about what you talked about today, and then we can talk more about that. So Zach, why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, I did my topic on how sport has been put into a political and social context in terms of shaping a sense of consciousness about the world. And I wanted to present both the positive effects and the negative effects.
Good. All right. Houston?
So I looked at the concept of the athlete as we move into the more mechanized age, specifically focusing on NASCAR and the convergence of man and machine, and almost seeing it as maybe a harbinger of things to come as sport continues to evolve, especially as noted, there are the cyborg games now in Switzerland that are being offered.
So. Yeah, that was really fascinating. You mentioned, I had not heard of that. I'm definitely going to go check that out online to see what that's involved. I'm curious to see what it looks like. I mean, it's probably not quite what my imagination plays it out to be in terms of, a bunch of Cylons running around, but.
Yeah, I mean, that could be a really fascinating thing, especially if they're planning a run on almost like a full decathlon or something like that to see what they're actually aiming to have happen or what may happen. So
It'd be interesting too to see what kind of interest that garners.
Sure.
You know, one of the things about, I guess, non-cyborg sport, natural sport or whatever that people want, like to talk about is how, you know, it's human beings and challenging their bodies and here's something a little bit different. And so it's interesting. People are interested in that.
Real quick before we move on. It's funny that you bring up something like where there might be a dichotomy between natural sport now versus in essence an augmented or enhanced sport. So, it might prove to be an interesting kind of evolution in sports. So,
Although I want to go to Carl first before we get into this, but one of the things we should come back to is this idea of what would it be to be natural? I mean, you're even using glasses and things like that. The equipment you use, those things all are augmented, you know, unless we're wrestling in the nude. Then
Sean, I'm all natural. I don't take steroids.
So, you know, then we got to go back to wrestling in the nude if we're going to really be this sort of natural sport.
Sure.
Which is a good segue to Carl. So what else were you talked about?
Yeah, I talked about, wrestling and boxing in our culture, what it means. Part of it was about, spectatorship, what the spectator got from it. Boxing and wrestling are a little bit different than football or baseball or basketball. Boxing, you want to hurt your opponent, maybe kill them, and that has a different cultural meaning. And wrestling is performance art. It works on a lot of different levels. I was talking to Zach in the parking lot when I changed.
Mm-hmm.
And
speaking of naked wrestlers.
Yes. So, I felt like a wrestler today when I gave my presentation.
Yeah, you put your whole body into it.
So. I was disappointed he didn't have a cape to come out to. Maybe some theme music next time.
I might next year, yes. Yeah.
But he did have a sense of passion about wrestling.
Definitely. Definitely.
It might have been the Red Bull, too.
Yeah. That helps. Which kind of image of the cape there. In the discussion period, you know, a lot of people kept coming back to your paper, Zach, which I think, you know, is a testament to the importance of the issues that you're bringing up in that. You know, one of the things that I was curious about was if you thought that there were certain sports that were more apt to encourage an influence on society one way or the other, negative or positive. Are there some sports that are just better suited to that versus other sports that might not be?
Well, I think it's about the sport that has a greater popularity and more of an influence than other sports. If you take the example of baseball, because baseball has such baseball is America's pastime, and it has a lot of influence, not just here, but all over the world. When an athlete is outspoken, or a baseball player is outspoken, it will garner more attention than, say, somebody in wrestling, for example. If somebody were to be more outspoken, it wouldn't draw more debate or garner as much attention as it would in a sport like baseball or football because it has all the popularity in terms of spectatorship and of television.
Yeah, and that does seem to be the bigger factor, right? Mm-hmm. Although, as it relates to some stuff that you were talking about, Houston, the issue that, you know, we don't really see what the NASCAR driver is doing. Where in baseball, we see them. There's no helmet. I mean, they have helmets, but nothing that really blocks their face. Mm-hmm. You know, even in football, you don't really see their faces. I don't want to use the word dehumanize, but you don't see them as you don't see the human. I'm trying to avoid another way of saying it without saying dehumanize.
I think, using the NFL as an example, I believe that what they almost do is they make people anonymous.
Is a better word, yeah.
So other than the name or the number, it's really the uniform that matters for something like football where they're able to do that. And that may actually play into why football doesn't actually work in that social. I mean, they really haven't been able to make a statement in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't think of football players by and large as the kind of players that the kind of having that influence where, you know, two of the examples that you pull from baseball and boxing – right, there's no anonymity there at all. I mean, it's all out there. So that I think makes that might be one factor there where something like football or NASCAR, where there are more anonymous because we don't really see them doing it as clearly, that might be a factor.
Well, there have been examples in football. The most famous example that I can think of a player who is outspoken would be Jim Brown, especially during the 60s. And he was one of those athletes who wasn't afraid to speak his mind and still to this day is not afraid to speak his mind. And he's been critical of athletes, particularly black athletes, for not being more outspoken on political and social issues. Mm-hmm. And as far as NASCAR is concerned, as somebody who grew up watching NASCAR and was a fan of it, yeah, you don't really see outspokenness, a driver saying or speaking his or her mind, but you do see political influence because if you really look at the demographics of NASCAR fans, you will see that the majority of them are overwhelmingly right-wing conservative Republicans. And mostly at the races, you'll see, prominent Republican figures, come to the races and they generally show a sense of camaraderie. Not to say that, for the other side that they exercise their influence among NASCAR fans, they do, but there's an indicator that shows that, there's a level of influence there.
Just a quick tag onto that, and it's definitely one of the things that I continue to look at, as I continue to delve into this thing of NASCAR. We have to recall that when Michelle Obama made her presence felt at a race, I believe it was last year, that she was roundly booed. I mean, the reaction towards her. So not only as a person of color, but probably from the Democratic side had to play into that. So, you know, we can sort of tacitly acknowledge that the stereotype of NASCAR fans are that white kind of right-sided people.
Yeah.
So it does play into that, and maybe that's a good field where we need some kind of social change. So,
Well, I mean, I wonder how much of that is changing, though. I mean, they talk about the growth of NASCAR across demographics as well, and so that may be that that was more an artifact of the past. I don't know. I don't follow NASCAR at all. I wouldn't call myself a fan of that at all. I mean, I've seen some matches. It can be exciting to watch, but it's not something that I've ever gotten into or really know anything about. And so I hesitate to even speak to that point about the demographics. I've heard that, that claim made. I don't know how accurate it is and how much we're just speaking from, you know, a Hollywoodization or popularization
or
of
just
that.
Generalities.
Yeah, just generalities. I mean, it would surprise me if it actually is that cut and dry. Just because, you know, when you look at the county by county electoral maps, there really isn't such thing as a red state, blue state. We're all purple, right? When you look at the counties, break it down by county. So I suspect that the NASCAR breakdown is probably something more similar to that. And it may just be certain more vocal groups than others that are garnering the focus of attention. But, that probably gets us a little off topic. Now the issue of the cyborg, that's pretty interesting. You know, so maybe we come back to this point about, a conception of what a natural sport would even be, because people talk about that. That comes up, particularly often comes up when you talk about performance enhancing drugs. Oh, well, you should do it naturally, right? And you made that joke, right, Carl? But I think there's an interesting, analysis that needs to be done about what natural even means in any of those contexts. So, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do, because even if you just think, let's say, in your more natural sports, training regimens and all these other aspects that have now played in, I mean, the dietitian aspect, I mean, where it's almost, you know, manufactured in a way, you know, so you've got these really developed senses of routine that create this athlete. You know, it's not just like that they're born now and they happen to work out and had some skill. Now they're in essence manufactured.
Right. It's a year-round thing, right? I mean, the kind of medical technology applied, I mean, you talk about Tommy John surgery, you talk about just therapies that are involved in people's knees and guys that, you know, you could be a season-ending injury or even a career-ending injury can come back in 3 months now, you know, from knee surgeries and things like that. And so I think that's pretty impressive in terms of the medical technology. And so does that Is that part of like a cyborgization?
I mean, right. And I used just wearing glasses as a part, right? And we've seen many athletes wear glasses and do just fine. But how much more beyond that does it make, you know, does that incorporation of technology distance a person from being actually what we consider natural? So it's one of those kind of sliding scales, it seems.
Yeah. Well, and then there's a descriptive aspect of that, of just trying to figure out, is there a scale there to describe? But then there's a normative aspect. Is it a bad thing? Is it something that undermines our humanity, dehumanizes us? Or does technology and incorporating technology, augmenting ourselves with some technology, is that a further expression of our humanity? I mean, that's in one way, you know, what we talked about Homo ludens from, Heisinger earlier, but it's, you know, we're in some ways maybe Homo technologists or something. I don't know what the Latin would be. All right. Did you want to jump in on that, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was hoping someone today would talk about players versus spectators.
Yeah.
And I think there's a big difference there. I somewhere in the mix, I said, we're all just watching television. So they're not necessarily real anyway. We're just watching images, whether that's a human being, a man, a woman, or a machine. We're in our living rooms with our electronic devices, looking at that. Mm-hmm. So I think the division for me has to do with playing versus watching.
Yeah. Yeah. And playing is, that raises the whole issue of what play is. It's something you sort of, got into a little bit, and we talked a little bit in the discussion period. You know, you have the contrast with work aspect of play, that some people want to just divide up, activities into play and work, and that those are mutually exclusive. We talked about the exuberance or the spontaneous exuberance that might be play, at least in kids and animals. But
I mean, I think play is really interesting, because generally we think of play as actually physically doing the thing. Like when y'all were talking about what's natural, but when you're watching television or your device, you can play, you can have a fantasy in your head. And that's not a physical, natural thing.
When you're saying something like that, are you actively engaged in play, or are you passively engaged in play if you're, in essence, you know, living through this electronic medium?
Good point. Passive, yeah.
Right. So so we now actually have two different kinds of play, if you want to think about it, right?
And that's why Heisinger, the concept of play is so interesting, because it's hard to get your grasp the meaning.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And I mean, I think the spontaneous or exuberant overflow, I think that captures some kind of play. I don't think it captures the play that maybe adults might be engaging in. And, you know, to think of play as just something that kids do obviously isn't going to be correct. We all engage in play of some kind or another, some more than others. But
I watched the Rockford kids playing Frisbee golf, and I don't think that was here last year, that there was a Frisbee golf field. That was I like that.
It is relatively new. I don't know if it was here last year or not. I don't. It's relatively new. They haven't. Zach, do you know when they put in the we? I grew up calling it Frolf.
Frolf. Yeah, I remember hearing that too. Yeah, but I don't remember when.
I think it's been a couple years at this point.
I would imagine so. It was. I do know that it was a student-led effort.
Yes.
To get a disc golf course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's gotten pretty big. So.
That's good. People have been playing it all day, so obviously it's pretty popular. Day, yeah.
But when I talked, I was begging on people not playing, not going out, going to a Bears game, spending all this money, tickets, merchandise, but not stopping at the rest area and throwing the Frisbee. And it was kind of refreshing to look outside, and there were kids throwing the Frisbee.
Well, you know, I was going to pop up when you mentioned that, and maybe people don't stop at the rest area, but when they're tailgating in the parking lot, you see a lot of people throwing a frisbee around, throwing a hacky sack.
Or
maybe.
I was going to say, or cornhole,
or throwing a football.
In Iowa, they say beanbag or bean. Bag, yeah. They don't say the word cornhole.
Yeah, that's
naughty in Iowa.
Yeah. But, you know, playing football or playing hopscotch, maybe, just to bring in the other earlier. Yes. But, so people do that, but then even. There's a sense that even going to the game is a kind of play as well.
But I think part of it is they commodified the spectacle of sport. So you're in essence, again, that you're actively playing by being there and watching, but you're also, I mean, that's how you are enjoying the actual sport at this point, and how it's packaged, sold, and, you know, in essence, rebranded ad nauseum.
And it's still passive? Even if you're doing the hacky sack?
No, I'm saying when you actually sit down, you know, you finally, but you've done all these activities, you probably stopped and got some drink, you know, it's like you've walked, you've done all these things to get essence, like, ready to sit there, right? So it's like it's become its own process to then become passively engaged.
I mean, I'm more cynical, so I would say spend that money.
Well, yeah.
Buy the merchandise, the hats.
Yeah. Well, I don't really think that being a spectator is inherently passive. I mean, you could certainly just sit there and be passive, drink beer until you're just right, and just not really paying attention. I mean, the way I spectate when I'm watching sports, it doesn't feel passive. My heart races. I'm jumping up and down. I'm cheering. I'm screaming. Right.
I'm waiting for a riot.
I know you're from Boston, but I grew up in Philadelphia, and I've never met a passive Philly fan.
Yeah, so. It's not a passive experience. And then so there's the physical aspect, but then the intellectual aspect, thinking about what's going to happen, what's the next move. What's the best strategy here? Was this a bad strategy? What should they do? So there's an intellectual element there to the, now it's.
As well as catharsis. I mean, I mean, that's a huge element of the whole process, right?
All right.
I mean, I think once you understand the hierarchy of whatever sport you're watching, it becomes more lively for you.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming more ingrained.
What do you mean by hierarchy?
Rules, regulations. Oh, okay. The more you watch, the more you understand.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever sport.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, going back to NASCAR, I don't really know anything about it, right? So I don't really know what's going on. It's hard to figure it out. It just looks like guys driving around in a circle. What's the fun in that? I mean, I know there's more to it, so I don't want to be dismissive.
No, that is it.
Well, that's not just I mean, there's a sense that's what it is, but there's a lot more to it. And similarly, you hear, I'm a soccer fan, you know, people that aren't soccer fans are like, it's just boring. You know, you guys just running around kicking the ball. It doesn't seem very interesting. There's not a lot going on. People say the same thing about baseball. You know, it's boring. And I don't think baseball is boring. I hang on every pitch. And the battle between the pitcher and the hitter, you know, even now in April, is still really interesting to me. And even if the overall game might not be as a total that interesting or that important to me, but just watching one batter versus a pitcher can be very interesting. And then those are just moments that build up throughout the game, throughout the season.
And I think that's going back to what you were saying about what is characterized as playing. From what we just talked about, it goes across all kinds of, it demonstrates itself in different ways, whether it's physically, mentally, intellectually, or even psychologically. You get so into the game that you almost feel as though you're not just a spectator, you're actively participating in the game because of your passion, because of a passion that you have for that mm-hmm. particular event.
Yeah. Well, and another issue that you brought up, Carl, you know, the connection to one's identity, right? You know, you were asking, so who, you know, what are you, a Bears fan, right? Or something like that. And that there is, I think, a deep connection to identity and fandom, particularly, you know, Boston fan, Philly fan, Yankee fan, right? I mean, it's a part of, you know, who you are. And it's not something that's just casual the way you might be like, oh, I like NCIS, right? Or something like that. I'm a fan of that show. That's a very different, even hardcore fans of a TV show, you know, I'm a brown coat. I watch Firefly, right? Which I am. And I do. But it's even that's different than the kind of identity connection I have to, you know, Boston sports, whether it's the Red Sox, the Bruins, Patriots, so on. That's a deep part of me. And so the experience of spectating is a way of experiencing and expressing that identity, which is also not really passive, even if it isn't, you know, physically active. So I think that that's another aspect of the value of spectatorship.
I mean, I like teams that make the playoffs but never win the championship. What does that say about me?
It means you like the Cincinnati Bengals?
I like the Cleveland Indians and the Washington Redskins.
All right. Yeah. Well, you said you like bad guys too, right?
Yes, certainly. So, I like bad guys.
Yeah. So, you know, that tells us, I think, probably, you know, if we were psychologists, we could psychoanalyze you in some way and figure a lot out about what you're like, Carl, just based on that.
I think it's my mother.
It always is, isn't it? It always starts with the mother. You know, another, going back to the cyborg thing, which mm-hmm. I think connects somewhat to identity too, is, you know, I can see one concern, and it was raised in the discussion about, you know, the sense of autonomy, right? Cause, you know, what are we concerned about oftentimes in these things is our personhood, right? And what does the fact that we have a bionic arm make us less of a person or not? What do you have a thought on that?
I do. And you say personhood, but I also think the element of control, mm-hmm. where it's not what the person can control, but outside forces can control. So if it's a sport, like how can someone regulate that person's, in essence, cyborg identity, right? Uh-huh. Or that cyborg ability. And I think that's where I see the issue with it. I think some people involved in the sports probably would love any enhancement they can get, right? So, right. I mean, anything that makes them bigger, faster, stronger, you know, typical thing is the next step. So it's kind of, I think I see it from the regulation side,
right,
as being the kind of issue.
So who gets to make the decisions?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think to some degree, some of these will be made more organically, you know, spontaneous and through spontaneous organization, right? So you hear, the cyborg Olympics or whatever, the cybathon. So here's a group of people. And if it's something that's popular and catches on, then it will grow more and you might see it integrated more into other sports. If it falls flat, you know, the other institutions might decide, we don't want to mess with that because some people might not want that experience. They might think, oh no, I want to see someone who's regular Joe like me, even though we're well past regular Joes like me playing professional sports.
Right. And there's still the question of someone like Oscar Pistorius, who is able to compete with the natural or regular people. Mm-hmm. And there is that fear that, I mean, that was part of the reaction to not let him.
Right. He goes from being disabled to super able.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a fascinating case, which is only made more gossipy by the tragic situation.
I know you're the ethicist, so his case really branches out in the ethics of sport more than almost anything else.
Yeah, so. Zach, you know, you probably remember, we talked about Oscar Pistorius in the sports ethics class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I do that in the sports ethics class every year because I think it raises – I usually try to do it after we talk about performance-enhancing drugs. Because I think it, and then I try to say, okay, well, here's all these arguments about why we don't allow performance enhancing drugs. What do any of these relate to this issue of someone using a technical aid, to perform in a sport where they otherwise couldn't because of a disability of some kind? But then also just the general issue of this is going to be going on more and more. And as the technology gets better and relates to the cyborg stuff, we're not going to see it. I mean, one of the things with Pistorius is you look at him and he's running on these blades. And you're like, what is that? Doesn't look like running anymore. When we are creating prosthetic limbs that we can't tell the difference from watching, and this gets back to your point, Carl, we're just watching things on TV, right? That, you know, that at what point does that just become, we don't even know. Mentioned now that people with the, what do you call that?
The plates.
Yeah, I'm looking at my wrist as if anyone can see me. Look. Right. So the plates in the wrist, the screws and knees and things like that, and microfracture surgery and things. So we're already sort of there.
Right. And I showed glasses, but we didn't consider laser surgery and any of those things where they actually can improve somebody's vision past 2020. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it is, you know, that enhanced ability.
Right. Well, and then, of course, the next issue kind of related to cyborg stuff too is genetic modification and gene therapy and using that as a means of doping, and that's one of the big hot issues, and but that's a whole other issue. But I think they all kind of do relate back to questions about what it is to be an athlete, what it is to be a person, and what do we care about in sport? Is it that they have a false limb, or is it that they have the agency and the control over what they're doing and doing things that we find interesting in the context of sport. Good.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Pointed towards Zach, but obviously up for anybody. So if you follow the timeline of, in essence, we're looking at social movements and people that have made stands in sports, and we start with Johnson, move on to Owens, and continue Robinson.
Oop. Good. We're good.
All right. Robinson, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of a drop-off after the 60s. We haven't really had somebody that's made a statement, in essence, a true social statement. And can you either say why that is or what you think the next one needs to be?
Well, to begin with, I think why it is because, as I pointed out during the presentation, was that athletes either, you know, don't feel the need to be outspoken on any issues because it would jeopardize their careers or what sponsorships that they or endorsements that they have intact, And also because of probably the changing times, they feel as though there isn't really any need to be overtly outspoken or to make a stand that would fall under the same context of what it was during the 60s, especially.
Yeah, I mean, there's the argument that we're supposedly living in a post-racial, in essence, society, right. But it's a little bit of hogwash.
Well, we're not, right. I mean, there's obviously a long way to go, but at the same time, we've come a long way.
That's true.
I mean, I wouldn't quite say we're post-racial or anything like that.
Right.
But, I mean, and some might say, well, we don't necessarily want to be. I mean, we're certainly not where we were in the 40s and the 30s, and the explicit and the dramatic racism, the institutionalized racism, that was there. And Zach and I talked a lot about this in the lead up to the conference. You know, I think to some degree, some of it is the images issue. That's certainly a factor. But, you know, a lot of it, I think, is more that, one, there just aren't that many big issues that one person could really speak to in the way that a Jackie Robinson could.
Right. I mean, after Title IX was enacted,
right?
Is there a next cause? I mean, other than the homo...
Yeah, I think the LGBT, transgender...
Right.
But did you have the picture? You had the trans...
Yeah.
Yeah. What's her name again?
Caster Semenya.
Right. I think those are some of the bigger issues coming down the pike as more and more of transgender individuals and then are going to be competing. And the privacy issues that are going to arise from that, as you were mentioning, and fairness issues about who's competing with whom. And I think another aspect is the homosexuals in sport as well. Although I do think that that's going to be, that's not going to be the, it's more of a fizzle rather than a boom, like the way Jackie Robinson was. And part of that, I think, as Zach mentioned, prior to Jackie, in the 1890s, there were a couple African Americans playing.
Moses Walker being the last.
You know, and then, so for 50 years, there was no African Americans playing in the sports and in baseball, and the other sports had similar sorts of rules, and segregation. But since all these sports were, you know, 1800s founded, we know just as a matter of statistical probability, there were gay people playing. Yeah. Back then, there were gay people playing in the 30s. There were gay people playing in the 60s and so on. So it's not like we need someone to be the first gay person, right? It's about the openly gay.
What we need is our first gay superstar.
Yeah. Right.
which is why it's when you talk about a movement, or somebody being outspoken, it's really a question of when, how, and where. Is the appropriate time to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, with regards to LGBT athletes, it's really not so much about the presence of LGBT athletes because there are, but whether or not they're open about it and transparent about it, mm-hmm. and aren't afraid of any possible hatred or bigotry that they would have to encounter. And the same thing, and I would argue the same for women athletes. I mean, mm-hmm. you think of, we have Title IX and we have the WNBA and we have, professional soccer, you know, NCAA championships.
Professional for women. Women's professional wrestling, right?
There you go. Yeah. So the question is, what I think their issue right now is trying to find a level of acceptance and recognition in terms of media representation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have the Battle of the Sexes between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, and we did have the 1999 FIFA World Cup, but that was only one moment where there was a hype, there was a buildup to it. So I guess the question is for women athletes now, whether or not that they can, find some kind of, representation or equal representation, in the media, not just on the playing field, but off the playing field.
Yeah. Well, and another issue there is I think going to come up is more women competing or trying to compete in traditional male sports.
Right.
Right. I think we'll see.
I was going to say, that's where it leads into my world, where Danica Patrick is able to, in essence,
absolutely
be on the same playing field.
Right. And I think you might see people in the WNBA trying to make the jump, tennis possibly, although I mean, there are physics issues there that are going that can prevent it, but I think in some sports it's going to be more amenable. Maybe a female kicker in football, Things like that.
We've had that in college football.
Yeah. So I think, I think you'll see some breakthroughs like that, but it's nothing on the, I don't think, not to downplay the importance of gender equality and these kinds of things, but it's not at the same level that that racism was, mm-hmm. In the 40s that Robinson had to deal with. And I think, a player like Michael Sam, the openly gay football player, who will probably get drafted, at some, third, fourth round, there's most predictions. Some say sixth. There's only seven rounds now.
Seven. Right?
Yeah. So, but he'll be on a team and see, and maybe he's a superstar. Maybe he's not. Maybe, but, if he's a superstar, one aspect of the fizzle, I think, is once the player's out and comes and does his job, no one's going to give a shit. Right.
Pretty
much. I don't think anyone's going to really give a shit. Just like ultimately they didn't with Jackie, right? I mean, eventually it took a little time.
Still won an MVP though.
Right. yeah. I mean, it took some time, but people ultimately wanted their team to win and mm-hmm. they recognized, hey, this guy can play, and I think it helps open their minds to, yeah, that's not really important, is it? His color of skin or, his sexual preference or anything. And I think that's the power, one of the powers of sport is that it makes us not care about other things because we care about winning. We care about our team and we want to see them do well. We care about achievement and excellence. And we recognize that these factors don't play into why they're excellent or, and all we care about is the excellence. Then what do we care about those other things? And I think that helps move us forward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that hopeful note, thanks, guys, for both coming to the symposium as well as, coming on to the podcast.
Sure. Thanks.
Thanks.
Could I say something?
Absolutely.
Men are from Mars, women from Venus. When they visit the Earth, they go to the Rockford Sports Symposium.
Thank you.
There you go.
That's Sean awesome. Klein lifting barbell plates, eating T-bone steaks, sweeter than chocolate cake.
Nothing sweeter than chocolate cake. No way. This has been the Sports Ethicist Show. You can find us at sportsethicist.com, Facebook, and Twitter. You can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.